Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, we're bringing you a special conversation with retiring Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. We look back at the issues he's worked on during 12 years in office through two administrations, discuss his advice for the incoming Ag Secretary, and reflect on what he wishes he knew entering office in 2009. But first, here's this week's headlines. As President Biden completed his final full week in office, many long-awaited rules and regulations were released. USDA released an interim rule making it easier for farmers' crops to be eligible for a valuable new tax credit known as 45Z. Sorghum will be eligible, as well as corn and soybeans. The rule gives growers more flexibility in the types of farming practices they use. The Food and Drug Administration banned the use of red dye 3 after citing studies that it showed a link to cancer in animals. The dye gives food and drinks a bright red color. The FDA also proposed a front-of-package labeling rule that would list information on saturated fat, sodium, and added sugars. The labeling requirement was a key piece of the Biden administration's strategy for combating obesity and hunger. USDA also has finalized a rule limiting poultry processors from paying reduced rates to producers through tournament ranking systems, while still allowing for bonuses. The regulation will take effect July 1st in 2026. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack will complete his tenure as the nation's second longest-serving Agriculture Secretary as the administration changes Tuesday. To begin our conversation, I asked how he thinks his three terms as U.S. Secretary of Agriculture will be remembered.
Well, I'm not sure how it'll be remembered, but I will tell you that it's been a great privilege and a great honor to work in this department with so many committed people who cares so deeply about rural people in rural places. And I'm obviously proud of the work we've done here. I think it's fair to say that over the last 4 years in particular, we've seen record farm income and record exports. But the reality is that not everyone has felt that they had a record year. And that's because of the nature of agriculture and the system that we set up, a production system that focuses on production. I think what we've done the last 4 years is we've created a new alternative, a new model, that gives people a chance, if they are smaller, mid-sized operators, to basically have a series of revenue sources, new revenue sources. So I'm very proud of the work we've done with more and new and better market opportunities, both in terms of climate smart agriculture and what that's going to generate for producers in the future. Excited about the work we've done on the competition agenda. As you know, we came into office, I think it was fair to say that the Packers and Stockyards Act, which is designed really to level the playing field for producers with as they deal with integrators in the marketplace, it needed to be reinvigorated. So we hired additional people to do a better job of overseeing the Packers and Stockyards enforcement. It needed new partners, which is why we worked with state attorney generals to create revenue and resources for them to be able to make sure that the marketplace was operating fairly and appropriately. And it needed a bolstering of the rules and regulations. And we are proud of the fact that we created a new transparency responsibilities. As farmers go into business with integrators, they need to know a little bit more about the financial condition of those integrators. Very proud of the work that we've done in making sure that if there's discriminatory actions or if there are retaliatory actions against farmers and ranchers for exercising their rights, that they are now protected from such wrongful acts. If I had to summarize all of this, what I hope we've been able to do is I hope we've been able to make this conversation, the conversation between the older generation of farmer and the next generation of farmer, a little easier. It doesn't have to be the conversation of we just can't make it work. It can be the conversation of we are going to make it work, and there's opportunity to ensure that the next generation and the next generation gets to do what they love to do, which is to farm a ranch.
We'll be back with more from Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack right after this.
These are the farmers and ranchers who helped build the America we depend on, and Farm Credit is here for them, supporting rural communities and agriculture with reliable, consistent credit and financial services. In good times and bad, we provide loans to farmers and ranchers, farmer-owned cooperatives, rural homebuyers, agribusinesses, and rural infrastructure providers. We help agricultural producers feed the world. Learn more today.
Think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you
yes.
asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
Welcome back. During the past 4 years, the Agriculture Department has focused heavily on climate and how farmers can benefit from addressing climate change, as well as the challenges facing small farms and farmers of color. The incoming administration has made it clear that they're going to roll back what this administration has done on both climate and equity concerns. We asked Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack if he's confident his work on climate smart agriculture will last into the future.
Well, I think you have to distinguish between a focus on climate and the focus on creating opportunity for farm and ranches to be more profitable. I think the way we have set up the Climate Smart Commodity Initiative by contracting with major organizations, farm groups, commodity groups, major universities, major food companies, major agribusiness companies, these are contracts. These are enforceable contracts in which we've agreed to invest over a period of years resources to allow our partners to be able to then pay farmers to embrace climate smart practices. The fact that we've seen tens of thousands of farms sign up for these programs, and that number increases every single day, is a reflection of the popularity of this idea out there in the countryside. So I am confident that those contracts will withstand any challenge. I think the partnerships that we've created are partners that will be able to come into USDA and advocate with the new administration that this is not in their best interest allow these contracts to be voided or rescinded, but that's actually in the best interest of farmers and ranchers for them to continue to receive payment for climate smart practices, continue to receive the premium that we're now seeing with over 40 to 45 products going into the stream of commerce with a value-added proposition, allowing farmers to take credit for developing sustainably produced food products. Regardless of party or regardless of which administration we're talking about, I would hope that we would see continued commitment from any administration, frankly, in the notion of conservation. It's something that's been bipartisan for quite some time, and I would hope that we continue to be so.
You've worked extensively on helping small and mid-sized farms during your tenure. How would you rate your progress on that?
Well, I think we've created the model. I think we've created the foundation. It has essentially two elements. It's the climate smart element, where we essentially are paying farmers for what they grow and how they grow it, and also opening up opportunities for them to be paid for the environmental result that they obtain on the farm by those who need that result to offset their own carbon footprint. I think we've certainly strengthened the local and regional food system effort by expanding processing capacity and literally hundreds of investments we've made there. Creating new market opportunities with our local food purchasing and local school purchasing agreements that are operating in states across the country. And the reason that the local and regional food system is so important is because the farmer better deal. When they go into the marketplace, generally when they sell their commodity, they get 20 cents of every food dollar that's spent at a grocery store. But when they sell directly to a customer, they get 50 to 75 cents of that food dollar. So it's a better deal for farmers. So we've created more opportunities, and I think it's one of the reasons why we've seen an increase in young farmers. It's one of the reasons why we've seen a reversal of the out-migration from rural America over the last decade or more. We've seen persistent poverty significantly reduced in rural areas. And I think we've seen that farmers now understand that there are multiple ways to keep that farm going. And I think we need to see the opportunity for this to continue. And if we do, I think as we talk about future farm bills, not the one that, that folks are currently working on, but future farm bills, we'll see, I think, an incorporation of this into a more stable, if you will, or more day-to-day part of what USDA does.
We'll be back with more newsmakers right after this.
Weeds, razor-thin margins, supply chain disruptions. American farmers need innovative solutions to tackle the threats that impact us all. Their yield is their livelihood and the food that feeds our families. That shouldn't be on the line. which is why the Modern Ag Alliance advocates for access to essential crop protection tools like glyphosate to keep the future of farming in secure, hardworking hands. Get the facts and see what could be at risk.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
The price of eggs is rising as a result of the bird flu. We asked Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack what advice he has for the next secretary on what she should be watching for to stop the spread of the disease.
Well, I think there are obviously a couple of important considerations. A continuation of the commitment that we've made in this administration to biosecurity. To the extent that we heighten, to the extent that we embrace and expand biosecurity so that we prevent the spread of HPAI. I think that's obviously one thing that's important, and I think there needs to be continued support for that effort. Secondly, I think it's obviously important for us to continue to indemnify, to protect, provide assistance and help to those facilities that are hit, and who have to depopulate, because right now that's the only option that's available. In terms of ultimately knocking this thing out, it's pretty tough to do when you consider that the source of it is wild birds. What we need to do is to figure out ways in which we can identify workable vaccines. We have vaccine today, but it candidly is just not workable. Here's why it's not workable. The current vaccine would require essentially poking little chicks or eggs multiple times in order to have the proper dosage of the vaccine. Well, that's one thing if you've got a backyard operation. It's something, again, if you have tens of thousands of birds that you have to manage. So we have to figure out a way of dispersing this vaccine in a way that is much more efficient. Secondly, we have to be able to distinguish between a vaccinated bird and a sick bird. Because if we can't distinguish, then it makes it very difficult for us to convince our trading partners that vaccination is going to work and also allow us to continue to trade in poultry. Finally, we need to make sure that we have vaccines that are effective not only for hens, but also for turkeys, so that we're in a position to utilize this vaccine for all types of birds who are being impacted by the virus.
During your career, you've seen biotechnology in the industry evolve, and now we're seeing precision ag and AI provide additional opportunities for transformation. How do we continue to provide a regulatory pathway that enables quicker acceptance of those new technologies?
It's a situation and circumstance where no single department can do things on its own. You mentioned biotechnology. Biotechnology has a number of masters, if you will, when it comes to the federal government. It has FDA oversight, it has EPA oversight, it has USDA oversight. That's one of the reasons why we attempted to streamline that oversight, to make sure that everybody understood what their lane was and for them to stay in their lane so that you could streamline and reduce the amount of time. When I came into this job in the Obama administration, it used to take 90 months to get a biotech trait approved. I challenged the notion that it would take that long, and we eventually got it down, I think, to about 18 months. That's still too long, but certainly much, much better than 90 months. So I think it does take a concerted effort focusing on streamlining processes, asking what steps are absolutely necessary and what timelines are reasonable for those steps to be taken, and making sure that you have the adequate resources. So if it's about streamlining, then maybe focus would be to make sure that you're maintaining the staff necessary to aggressively and in a timely way do what needs to be done. Now, some will say we don't need to regulate. Well, that's fine, except that we're working and living in a global economy where if we're interested in exporting agricultural products, we're going to have to explain to our trading partners the systems that we have in place to ensure that whatever it is we're selling is safe, that it's not going to create problems for their producers or for their customers. Well, that requires you to be able to prove that it's gone through a regulatory process.
We'll be back to ask Secretary Vilsack to reflect on his time in office right after this.
I think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
Weeds, razor-thin margins, supply chain disruptions. American farmers need innovative solutions to tackle the threats that impact us all. Their yield is their livelihood and the food that feeds our families. That shouldn't be on the line, which is why the Modern Ag Alliance advocates for access to essential crop protection tools like glyphosate to keep the future of farming in secure, hardworking hands. Get the facts and see what could be at risk.
AgriPulse's founder, Sarah Wyant, covered Vilsack's first day in office as Ag Secretary in January of 2009. We asked Secretary Vilsack what his initial vision was when entering office and how that vision has changed over his 12 years in the role.
No matter how much you study or how much you think your prior experience in whatever position you may have had before you become the Secretary of Agriculture, you don't know what you don't know. It's an amazing department. It's got an extraordinary reach. Many departments and many agencies in the federal government have a very deep portfolio, which is to say it's very focused. If you're the energy secretary, you're focused on energy. Now, there are different forms of energy, but you're focused on energy. If you're the transportation secretary, you're focused on getting people from here to there. When you're the ag secretary, you're focused on all of that. You've got an energy portfolio. You're investing in infrastructure and transportation. You're investing in nutrition. You're investing in food safety. You're investing in natural resources. You're investing in research. You're investing in universities. It is the broadest portfolio of any department of the federal government. And as a result, it is not fully appreciated, in my view, by the folks in Washington, D.C. in terms of its extent and length of its reach. 75% of the land mass of the United States is rural. As you stay in this business and stay in this department, here's what you learn. You learn that the portfolio is broad. You learn that the people who work here are incredibly committed. They care deeply about rural America and the people in rural America. And you also begin to fully appreciate and understand the contribution that rural America makes to the rest of the country. And then you become frustrated. You become frustrated because the level of support for the department is not commensurate with its responsibility. I've been trying to explain to people about the federal budget as if it was a large funnel. And I'll ask people, I'll say, where do you want to be in the funnel if you want to get your maximum amount of support? You want to be at the top of the funnel, where the funnel is largest, right? Well, who's at the top? The Defense Department. Defense Department never gets cut, almost never, never. They take a very large chunk of that federal budget. And so by the time that federal budget ultimately gets down to the USDA and like organizations and departments, we're at the spout of the funnel, which makes it difficult to do everything that needs to be done. I think we've done what we can. We've used the tools that are available. And I would say that's something else I've learned. There is a tendency outside of USDA to think of the only thing that really matters is the Farm Bill. That is really important, but so is the budget. So is the Commodity Credit Corporation. And now so is the Inflation Reduction Act and the infrastructure law that provided additional resources. Those four elements need to work collaboratively and in a comprehensive way to create the level of support and assistance and investment that's necessary to make sure that we do right by rural places.
And if you could go back to that time in 2009 when you entered this building as Ag Secretary for the first time, what advice would you give your former self?
I think one piece of advice is to understand that the and this is very technical, but to understand the dynamic between people who work at USDA as a career versus people who work at USDA based on a political appointment. So you have two classes of people, two groups of people that basically run this place. You've got the career people and you've got the political people. Now, the political people are the secretaries and the undersecretaries, the administrators, and those folks, the chiefs of staff, all those folks. There is a tendency for folks who are political to want to come in and they are fresh, they are full of energy, and they have no idea how difficult it's going to be because they think that they can just do stuff, but you just can't do stuff. I came in here thinking, well, when Congress appropriates money, we get to invest those resources. Well, turns out that's not the case. You can't invest it until OMB, the Office of Budget Management, allow you to invest it. Well, gosh, that's frustrating because they don't give you the money. They dole it out, sort of like a parent and a child. Here's your allowance every quarter. This is what you can spend. You're excited about this. You're ready to go. You want to do a lot. And then you come in and you say, let's do this and this and this, and let's do it right away. The career folks who've been here forever and know the system and know the process and know that you have to prioritize and know that some things take longer than others, well, they have to provide advice to you. You have to be open to it. You have to understand that you're a sprinter if you're a political person. They are marathoners, okay? And you need to respect it. You need to listen to them. You need to figure out ways in which you can encourage them to be part of the process of formulating policies and ideas because they are the ones who are going to have to implement.
And for this last question, I'll give you the open mic. Many folks in agriculture, journalism, politics, and every sphere will try to define your legacy as you leave office as the second longest serving agriculture secretary in the country's history. I'll give you the open mic here. What should they be writing or saying about you and saying about your legacy?
That I had an incredibly high respect for people who live, work, and raise their families in rural places. That I worked every single day to expand economic opportunity so that that discussion at the coffee table could be about how a farm could succeed to the next generation and not how it was get big or get out. I would hope that people would see that this is an administration that did right by the nutrition programs and sought for ways in which those who were struggling could be helped. I would hope that they would see that we've created a new set of opportunities. I think if anything, it's about opportunities. We've expanded opportunities. I have a hard time defining legacy because I don't think in those terms. I just see a problem and I try to solve it. And the problem I've seen is that too few people are benefiting from the current system. And it's important for everybody to benefit. Not the few, but the many. So that's not a particularly articulate articulation of a legacy, but I know this. I walk out of this place knowing that I gave it my all. And I walk out of this place knowing that that we made a difference. And I think things are better than they were when I came in many, many, many respects. And that's all you can ask for.
We'll be right back with a look at what to expect in the week ahead.
Elevate your game and set your sights on Denver for the 2025 Commodity Classic. With technology that moves faster than fluctuating markets and information as important as a million-dollar rain, Commodity Classic is designed for growers of all kinds, where you'll broaden your horizons as you improve yield and ROI one bushel at a time. Take your operation to new heights and join us for Elevating Excellence in Agriculture, March 2nd through 4th in Denver. Learn more at CommodityClassic.com.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks for joining us on this week's AgriPulse Newsmakers. Next week, Donald Trump will be inaugurated as the 47th President of the United States on Monday at the U.S. Capitol. After the official swearing in, he will participate in the inaugural parade. Members of the agriculture community will gather Monday evening for the bipartisan inaugural Ag Ball. Brooke Rollins, Trump's pick for agriculture secretary, will have her confirmation hearing on Thursday. President-elect Donald Trump is expected to make a sweeping list of day one executive orders. Check our website, agripulse.com, for the latest on the transition and more. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.